Test 1, 2. Okay, we'll call the Information Technology Committee to order, and we'll call the roll.
Chairman Weiss?
Here.
Representatives Mock?
Here.
Owens?
Here.
Striley? Thorson?
Here.
Tolman?
Here.
Senator Shibley?
Here.
Burkhard? Marsley? Miller?
Here.
Robinson?
Aye.
Mike Ressler?
Here.
Okay, I guess we have a quorum. Okay, the first order of business is... Well, I like that. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Motion's carried. By the way, that was a motion for the minutes. Oh, okay. Well, that's what I call really efficient meeting. Okay, well, we'll start with our 905 agenda. Mike?
Good morning, Chairman Weiss and members of Legislative IT Committee. My name is Mike Ressler. I'm the North Dakota Chief Information Officer. And my report this morning is going to be fairly brief. We don't have a whole lot of things that are happening since the last meeting. Of course, we have a lot of projects that are still going on, but won't necessarily be talking a lot to that. What I wanted to bring up primarily was two items, and then we're going to get into really the exciting part of the ITD report, and that Sheldon Wolf's got some really exciting stuff to tell you with regards to health information technology or the health information exchange. But I wanted to just give everyone an update. At the last committee meeting, you were briefed by Ide Bailey with regards to the desktop support study that was being done. And so what's the status of that? I did meet with the governor to get some direction from the governor's office to say, where do you want to take this? And the game plan is ITD is in the process of defining the service. What would a service be that we are providing for state agencies? And this is just some examples of what we would do. But to kind of give you an overview, the thought would be it would be a complete system that we would provide. Just like we do, say, the telephones. Today, if you buy telephone service from ITD, we provide the instrument and the service and the support and everything that goes with it. The thought behind this desktop support service would be similar. We would buy the desktop, whether it be a laptop, desktop, the device, own that device probably, and then provide the support, all the software, the configuration, all the antivirus, spyware stuff that goes with it. So what? Now that we've defined the service, our game plan is we're going to go and actually visit with some of the agencies. If you remember from the study, the recommendation was state agencies of 100 staff or less should probably buy that service from ITD. And so we want to actually go out there and talk to those agencies and get their input, what it is they'd like about that service, how they'd recommend we change that service. And then, of course, we have to look at costs, and because, again, if ITD provides that service, the agencies actually have to pay for it. And so we want to wrap that piece up as well, work with the Office of Management and Budget, and then come back to you probably before the last Legislative IT Committee meeting, I'm thinking, and give you kind of a final plan as to what you're going to see in the upcoming budget. So not a whole lot happening there other than we're making progress, and I just wanted this group to have kind of the latest. So the other topic is one I really love talking about, and that's, of course, the new building that ITD is going to lease. Just want to remind everybody again, this is not a state-owned facility. This is one that is being built by a company out of Fargo called Lexstar. And this is a map of where that building is located. It's up on 43rd. I got a better diagram. If you stand on the 18th floor of the Capitol building, you face north, and you snap a picture, that's what you'll see. So you can actually see that building out to the north. There's actually getting to be some structure there. That's a picture I had shown you earlier as to what the building would look like, a four-story building, 85,000 square feet. That's what it really looks like. That's the view from the south, and then that's the west view of the building. the north view of the building. You can see how it's kind of tucked into the ground. And then if you're sitting in the DCN parking lot and take the picture, that's the east side of the building. You're facing west, of course, looking out east from the building. That is what the facility is going to look like. Still being told that the building will be complete July 1st of 2014, which I think is still very aggressive, but John Boyle is the expert, and I rely on him heavily, and he's starting to feel like that might be a date they can actually hit. I'm thinking if they miss July 1st, it wouldn't be by much. It would be August 1st. A little bit with regards to the building, I know there was some concern at the last, during the last legislature with regards to the cost. In the contract that we've signed with Lexstar, it's a $12 per square foot lease, and then we're responsible for the common area maintenance fees. They're called CAM fees, and they're estimated to be about $5 a square foot per year, so about $17 a square foot. When you compare that to the other rents, for some of you that are on the Government Services Committee and have seen the different leases, it might be kind of in the middle to maybe a touch on the high side today. But the beauty to this lease, and I give John Boyle all the credit, it was a 10-year lease locked in at that rate. And then the state has the option to renew for a second 10 years, and the rate increase is limited to the cost index from year 9 to year 10. So just assume the inflation index goes up 3%, I guess. That's what that $12 fee would go up, 3%, and then that would be good for 10 more years. So in 18 years, when I stand before you here and tell you about this great building, I'll be bragging about how that's probably the cheapest rent we're paying in the state of North Dakota, and so pretty excited about that. And of course, we're hoping that the building actually works out as well as we're hoping it to. Again, if you remember, the game plan is when we're in five different locations in Bismarck today, ITD is, this will put all of ITD in one location, so can't wait for that to happen. Hope we can gain some real efficiencies by doing that. So, Chairman Weiss, members of the committee, that's all I have for an update. If you have any questions, I would love to try and answer them.
Senator Mock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many square feet are we going to be leasing? What's the size of the interior side of the size of the building?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Mock, there's 85,000 square feet in the building. Yeah, 85,000.
Thank you.
Yep. The hills. It's one of those little putt-putt golf courses.
Representative Sorensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike, again, the space you are utilizing here in the Capitol right now, you're going to keep some people here, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thorson, that is correct. We're going to keep a little bit of space actually where my office is. One of the requirements from the governor before he approved LISA to pursue this was that during the legislative session, he wanted the CIO to physically be located here during the session. And then, of course, we're going to keep the data center here. And so there's the area next to the cafeteria that we have some space back there. Currently, facilities management is moving taking some of that space to do more. I think it's for the legislature to have kind of a conference room back in that back room, but we're going to keep some of that space as well.
How many square feet in the Capitol will you be vacating then when you move into the new building?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thorson, I should know that, and
that's
don't.
Okay.
We have that whole first floor that kind of wraps around.
Right, and that's going to be used by some other agencies that are going to take that. I just couldn't remember the number. I'm sure we heard it last year during session, but
offhand, I don't remember.
Okay.
Dan
right.
Could look it up real quick.
It's not that big of a deal. Thank you.
Any further questions for Mike? Okay.
Okay. Thank you. You're next, Sheldon.
Hey, Sheldon. Morning, everybody. For the record, I'm Sheldon Wolf. I'm the Health Information Technology Director for the state of North Dakota. Just here to give you kind of a little bit of an update on where we are. Hopefully everybody saw the press releases and the things from last week where we indicated that the North Dakota Health Information Network has gone live. I'm going to kind of walk you through where we are, bringing people on board and doing some things like that, and then just do a brief demonstration on it. So if you got questions as I go through, fare away. Currently, we have 140, it's almost 150 organizations have signed participation agreements and business associate agreements with us. Pretty much all the hospitals in the state have done it. Now we're starting to move into some of those allied professionals. We're getting a lot of chiropractors and pharmacies and other ones that are coming on board and things like that. So we have 140 organizations. We have 790 plus users set up for the IndyHim Direct, which is the direct secure email messaging, I think that we talked about and before that. That number keeps up going dramatically. And as an example, in the state, as an example, Medicaid has started using Direct to require all the claims attachments that cannot be sent electronically to be sent across using Direct. Because there's PHI information in there and they want to make sure that that stuff is secure. So even the state government is moving into this process and starting to utilize the technology that is here because it's out there, it's secure, and it takes care of some of those issues with them. And then we're onboarding about 35 organizations right now. Those are the organizations that really provide information into the system, and I'll show you who those are in a second here. And we are live, we're populating data into the production system. So to kind of give you an idea where we're at with that, you can see the greens on there, those are in production. Jamestown Regional Medical Center was really our pilot area, that's where we really started. We needed somebody that was willing to come to the table, work with us to get the infrastructure set up and everything like that. They did that. We start out usually with the admission discharge transfers. That really gives us the information about an individual. And then we move into labs and radiology reports and things like that. So you can see we have them. We have Sanford Fargo, St. Alexis, Sanford and Bismarck should be coming on this week with their ADT feed. All True Health should be coming on this week with their feeds. The immunizations, I think, is ready to roll over about has that'll come. What that does is it actually allows them to put in an immunization within their own system, their EHR system, and it feeds the information system at the health department. That really works pretty well and gets rid of a lot of the double keying that you've heard about probably in the past. Essential Health, their admission, discharge, and transfer is on, and the immunization should be this week. Trinity Health, everything should come on this week. So you can see there we've pretty much covered the large hospitals in the state with the information that is there. And then we've also worked with the local public health units. There's 13 of them out there that use a product that's called Champ Software. And their ADT feed should be coming on this week, and I think probably next month we'll roll their immunizations on board where it automatically comes through their systems too. So it's not just the large ones, we're also working with some of the local public health units that we have out there to make life easier for the nurses and so they can access information. Additionally, along with that, here's the rest of the list that we're really working with. These are in some phase of onboarding with us. I mean, it could be the process where we set up the virtual private network where we have a network that's a direct connection between us and them, encrypted through that process, or we're onboarding them and working through the ADT feeds, the admit discharge transfer feeds, and those type of things. So you can see there's a lot of different hospitals out there, critical access hospitals, and even some of the smaller clinics that are out there, and even the university system, we're working with them in relation to that. Kind of where we are in our contract status with Orion. If you remember, we had a different contractor for a while. We mutually terminated that contract and went with Orion, and I'm thankful we did. It's a partnership that is really working pretty well. Because everything goes, you know, you never have that with a vendor situation, but we can make a phone call and we can work through the issues, and that really is the key thing that I see with working with any vendor. The core infrastructure and Direct is set up. The implementation of the HIE solution and the integration of the initial participants are all complete. The onboarding of one additional participant is in process, should be done this week. The patient portal, they've rebuilt their patient portal, so it's going to be a little bit. It'll be sometime in April. We'll have that one completed. The public health reporting implementation is completed. So as we bring on a hospital and they get their lab results coming through, if there's any reporting that needs to go into the Department of Health, it automatically does that. We work with the Department of Health staff very closely and be able to send information through to them. So it creates an opportunity where the providers don't have to go out and send information to them, but it actually helps the health department to some degree because they get better and quicker information. The immunization registry integration is in process. It's working. We've already got the gateways built, but we haven't signed off on it yet until we get a couple more participants through that, and that should happen this week. The eHealth Exchange Gateway is in the process. That'll, we got to go through some testing and some things like that. What that really does, and to me, I think this is one of the big areas, is it allows us to share information across state lines. So as other health information exchanges join the eHealth Gateway, we can exchange information with them. Plus, we're also working with Social Security and the Veterans Administration. The Veterans Administration is really key because there's a lot of veterans around North Dakota that go to Fargo and different places. We need to be able to get their information back and forth between their local clinics, so that'll be there. And Social Security, the way they want to do it is they sign, the patient signs an individual, they can come into the health information exchange, get their information, and they can determine their eligibility for Social Security. And what they found in other states is it saves many weeks in relation to determining somebody's eligible for Social Security. So that is really definitely a benefit for individuals in North Dakota that are disabled or looking to become, are disabled and looking to get on the Social Security so they can get insurances and different things quicker that way. DSM 2.0 is our next round of direct secure messaging. So we're going into a new one. HPD is just a provider directory that is out there. Because as we get set up with these, we need to be able to share provider directories with other states. We have a lot of people along the Minnesota-North Dakota border that do work with Minnesota people. We need to be able to see physicians in Minnesota so they can share information securely across state lines. Business Intelligent Utilization Dashboard is kind of the tools that we use to see what's going on in the system. That's coming up and should be up this week. User Adoption Services and Training Services are just services that provided us to help us with the training area so we can go out and provide training. So those are kind of all the areas that we have out there. It's been going very well, actually. Any questions so far? Otherwise, I'm going to jump in and just give you kind of a quick demonstration of the clinical portal piece of it, what a physician would see when they're out there.
Any questions from the committee? I guess not.
So this is when they open up the clinical portal, and this is where they go out and they actually can query on an individual. This is what they see. And, you know, by using this application, they're consenting to agree to the rules and regulations that we have in place and things like that, the privacy and the participation policies. Plus, we also give them a warning out here because if they're going to actually look at an individual, because of some of our state laws around some of the STDs and different things like that, we need to make sure that we tell them that they could see some information about a child that the child may not want to share with their parents. So we really just kind of warn them on that. It's really no different than the current EHR systems. If they're in there, they have to still be aware that it's really up to a doctor. We just want to give them another warning in relation to that. That's why you see the red stuff there. So here what you get when you pull up here is a patient portal, and you can go in and you can search for people. So you just type in a name, and you can put more in there than that when you want, but you can go in and pull that information up. And I apologize, this doesn't show up very well. But I pulled up an individual that has opted out. That's a question we usually get. We had a law in relation to that. It was Senate Bill 2250 last time. If somebody wanted to opt out of the system, what happens? Their information is in the system, but it's not queryable. So if they put that in there, what they get is they see they opted out. You cannot get into that individual at all. There's no way. Nobody can get into search. They cannot see any information. So if somebody opts out on that, that's what they would get. Last time I asked on how many opt out we had in the state of North Dakota, so far it was 12, to give you an idea where it is. So there's not a lot of people that have opted out. But historically, in my anticipation, what we'll see is somewhere around 1-2%. That's what other states that use an opt-out strategy will see, is around 1-2%. I'm expecting a few more of that, you know, because right now what's happening is providers are giving out the information to patients as they're coming in. They're seeing our advertisements that are on TV. They're seeing that we're getting questions. So I anticipate we'll get more than that, but right now we don't have a whole lot of those.
Well, Sheldon, the information is only available to the provider that created the information to start with.
Yep, it'd be, Mr. Chairman, it would only be in their system is where they would have to go and get it. That's correct. It would be up to those to go in and look. They wouldn't be able to get it through here.
If it's Jamestown Hospital, they have available, they'd have it through their EHR, but nobody else would have access.
That's correct. And the risk, you know, the risk that the individual takes is if everything is in Jamestown and they have allergies or medicines and they end up in Bismarck here and something happens to them, nobody has access to their information. That's the risk that they take in that, but that's their choice. That's why we wanted to give them a choice.
But now under this scenario, if that person was in the accident in Bismarck, for example, if he says at that point you can have access, is there a procedure?
There is, but we wouldn't have time to be able to turn that around.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
So what they would end up having to do at that point is calling right to Jamestown and getting the information the way they currently do it today. But if that was the case and the way they wanted to do it, then we'd probably go into the second option that we would have out here. Using Harry Henderson. And Harry Henderson, he actually, the other option is you can, you're in by default, you're out completely, or we have what we call emergency access. So you can see here, we have a little bit more information on this individual, but it's emergency access. And if we click on him, when it comes up, they have to tell us in this process that it is emergency access. And then they're able to get into the record. So to answer your question, Mr. Chairman, they could do that and just say they want emergency access rather than opting out completely, because that would give them the opportunity when they're in that emergency situation that they would be able to go out and look at that information. And then the physician would have to go out and what they call break the seal, and then they would be able to get in. And we can audit to this point. So we can go out there and see, did this really happen? So if a provider's out there saying everything is an emergency situation, it's really not, we're going to work with everybody and say, hey, you know, this guy said 50 times it's been emergency access. He's not an emergency room doctor. What's going on? It doesn't make sense. So we can go in and look at those type of things and work with the facilities in relation to that. Okay? And then the last case is for somebody that hasn't opted out. We'll use Mickey Mouse. They're opted in, so you can see that. And the reason why it comes up here, if you don't have a treating relationship with a provider, we're still going to ask you why. So it just isn't automatic access into it. You're still going to have to answer why you haven't done it. So if you're not their normal primary physician, and you don't have a treating relationship with them, which we get through their admit, discharge, and transfer feeds, you're going to have to come in and actually say why. And you can go in and say, hey, you know, I'm their primary physician, mid-level, and maybe they never had it, but now I am. And you can break the privacy seal and go in. It's just another step, another piece of security to give people some little bit of comfort in relation to using it. So once we have that, I'm going to see if I can shrink this down a little bit. Can you guys still read that? Okay. So what that does is it brings up kind of the summary information there. And if you look here, it gives the three different OHCPs here. This is a little bit different, but it'll tell you actually where the information came from. So it'll say like Sanford Fargo, it'll say Jamestown, it'll say St. Alexis Trinity, those type of things. So when somebody's looking at this information, they have a really good idea where this individual's been. If nothing else, in an emergency situation, at least you have a place to start. You know which three people to call. You're able to get that information. It gives you their contact information, it gives you their demographic information. As it goes down, it gives you allergies and alerts, medication history, which we haven't started bringing in yet. We're building the foundation, that is one we're going to start working with the pharmacies to be able to bring that information in. You got your problem lists, encounter histories, you know, any procedures that they had done. You know, you think about it, you're sitting in an EHR in emergency room and somebody had a heart attack and they had stents put in and things like that a month ago, and all of a sudden they end up in a different emergency room. At least that physician, when they're looking at it, knows exactly probably where to start. They're able to go in and see those type of things. There's a lot of other information here. The NDIS immunization information is here. We're really trying to get to a one-click shop, so all the information, this takes just a little bit of time. You can see on the top there the immunizations that were done. And then there's also what they call the forecaster down below down here. And what that says is if they go in to see a clinician and they need to get a meningococcal or an Hep B or any of those type of things, it'll tell them when they're needed so they can get them. So it should make our compliance better with it, because there's another tool out there, they can see what's needed out there for the individuals. And then I'll just show you a couple other things here. We do have the capability of bringing in different testing out there, the lab testing. So you may have a lab at one spot, you may have a lab at another spot. The EHR systems don't have all those, but really we consolidate them. So if you had some in Fargo, you had some in Bismarck, you had some in Minot, you had some in a critical access hospital, they're providing the information system. You can bring them all together and you can see them. And you can go out here and if you select a couple of them, you can even graph them to be able to see what's going on with an individual. So if you're sitting there working with somebody that has been to multiple different places, you can go out and see what's really happening in their history. Is this abnormal or not? Is this the way they've always been for the last 3, 4, 5 years? You know, think about it, you're in a critical access hospital, you do all your work out in a small town, but all of a sudden you get referred to Bismarck. They don't have all your information. Here they're able to go in and see it and see the trend lines and those type of things. Radiology gives you all the radiology reports that are out there. We're currently working on another piece of it, so that when you bring in, you know, let's say I had a left hip fracture, we're working with a amendment on our contract with Orion to be able to just click on a link here and actually bring up the images. So that way you don't have to, one, take a disc with you everywhere you go, the images will be available to you, or two, you get transferred from one place to a tertiary hospital or anything like that, and the information isn't there, they don't have to run you through a whole other set of x-rays and different things. The information, you can go out and look at it. And the last thing I'll add is over here on the left-hand side, we don't have it on this demo software yet, we are also adding in here the prescription drug monitoring program. So as an individual comes in and they want to be able to see the information through the prescription drug monitoring program, they don't have to go out to another website. That's one of the things that they have talked about, that they have to go to multiple websites to get everything. We're trying to make this a one-stop shop. And if you think about it, when we work with some of the bigger systems like the Epics, this is just a click on their own system. So they go right into this, right in from their system. We're able to build that technology into it too. So a doctor can sign in once and get to all these different pieces as we work through it. So that's what I had for a demonstration. I just thought I'd give you an opportunity for you guys to see it today.
Senator Shelby?
Mr. Chairman, Sheldon, a couple questions. First of all, you have a number or percentage of the emergency access only account?
We don't yet, because we're just starting, Mr. Chairman, Senator Shriver, we don't yet, because we're just getting to the point of bringing the information into the system. And we'll go, as we get down the road, we'll be able to do all that stuff. We don't have those data yet.
Of those three levels that we have of opt-out, emergency access, and totally in, I guess, can they change those status at any time, or?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shriver, yes, they can. The document that we have out there, they can sign off on it if they want to change it. Let's say they opted out and they want to opt in because they were at their doctor and realized, man, I should have stayed in the system. They complete that same form and say they want to opt in, so they can change them at any time. Yes.
The last question I'd have would be a question I always get is you know, and I know this isn't true, but people say the only people that can get access is everybody else, and I can't even see my own stuff. So how would a, you know, so what do I tell a person that says, I want to see what's on my record? The only avenue they have is to go to their physician and ask them?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shibley, currently the way that is, if they want to get their printouts and things like that, they need to go to their doctor, because that's the truth, the source of the information. But as we're going through this, we're going to build a personal health record. It's one of the components that we have, and as that gets built out, that information will get put out there, and then you'll have access to that, which will have the medical information from all the different sources that are providing it. So it is coming. The problem that I see personally in relation to it is I do my work here in Bismarck. So if I go to Sanford, I go to Mid-Dakota Clinic, and I go to St. A's, I could potentially have three different personal health records from them, which don't come together. And I think that's an issue as we move forward in this through the state that we're probably going to have to have some conversations with about it. But that's 2-3 years down the road.
Sheldon, when you mentioned the form, that form going to be basically in all the doctor's offices? So when that patient's there, if he says something, either I want to opt out or opt back in, they'll have it there? I mean, Because are they going to be aware that, okay, this is where I got to go to get this form so I can change what I want to do?
Mr. Chairman, we work with the providers in relation to that. They got access to it. It's on the website. They could print it out to anybody that wanted it. And it's actually form fillable on our website. So if they go out and complete it out there and hit submit, it actually comes right into us automatically. There's multiple ways for it. And what we've done is we've actually got a travel folder, and I think I actually handed them out the last time for, and if you didn't, I can get them for you guys, for the patients that they're handing out to everybody as they come in, which gives them all the information. And actually, Senator Scheibel, it actually addresses your information that they have the right to get access to all their medical information and things like that. It actually gives them their patient rights, which a lot of people don't know. So if you guys want, I can run up here and get some and give them to you after the break. But
my other question would be, you know, Senator Shively talking about getting your personal records. Well, if I went to, say, my doctor at Mid-Dakota Clinic, as you were mentioning those three, doesn't he'll have access to all the records from the other providers? Can he pull them all up, print them out, and give them to me, or not?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you're totally right. There is an opportunity out there, and I didn't show you where it actually consolidates all the records in what they call a CCD, a continuity of care document, and there is a print function. They could definitely do that. That's very true. Thank you. I haven't thought about that one.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Miller.
Mr. Chairman, I was going back to the beginning of your demonstration. It said there was a disclaimer for a minor. Is that a typical thing? It's, you know, if the minor doesn't consent, a guardian or parent can't know?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, it relates to just around a certain couple of certain tests and different things that are out there. And the doctors and the physicians are aware of that. So when we put that out there, is we just want to remind them that there are certain things that if the minor does not consent to, I mean, that's what's in state law, that they cannot share that with the parent. So it's just a reminder to them in relation to that, because we don't want them to use this system and say, well, I got it from here and I can share this information with their parent. No, there are some things in state law that you can't without the minor's approval in it.
Thank you.
There's also the federal HIPAA laws that that affect what information a parent can get on his minor child.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, it's around like STDs and some things like that, where there's some things, some testing that they can have done without their parents' consent.
Any further questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. I guess we're ready for our 9:45 agenda.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jody French. I'm serving as the Director of the Education Technology Council, and I'm also serving in my former position as Director of EduTech. I just wanted to give you some brief updates about our organization and the two umbrellas under it, which include EduTech and the Center for Distance Education. Just a quick review of our mission. Our goal is to serve the K-12 community by providing technologies that improve teaching and learning. Some updates about the council. We have been working very hard on the state longitudinal data system. The council employs a data steward along with a PowerSchool team from EduTech, and so we've worked to get as many teachers and administrators as possible using the SLDS this year. We've approved all state and local technology plans. As you know, those are required for E-rate. We were a little bit concerned about our E-rate percentage, perhaps decreasing with the increase of incomes in Western North Dakota. That did not happen. Our E-rate discount will remain at 64%.
Okay.
We're very busy with the Active Directory project. That's in the RFP phase. You've probably heard us speak about that before. That will allow us to provide Office 365 for every teacher administrator and engage every teacher administrator with a single set of credentials to access DPI services like STARS and TINET and all the K-12 applications with one set of credentials. We also have an internet filtering RFP in progress, and that new product will provide a little bit more flexibility than we have now and will also allow for mobile computing. The council just did a grant round. You can see that the six winners, I actually have a typo there, I write five, but there are actually six for the classroom transformation grants. Those were typically one-to-one initiatives, different intervention type pieces of software to improve reading scores. And we also worked with CenturyLink and provided three grants. You'll notice that nearly all of those grants include Bismarck Going East. and that's simply because we receive so few applications from Western schools. In the recent classroom transformation grants, we received one app from Billings County, and that was the only one in all of Western North Dakota. We did get denied a rural utility services grant. We were awarded one last biennium, so we'll use those video grant dollars we have on a local level, awarding schools in the state and not using it as a match for the rural utilities grant. We're also pursuing additional grant funds for some wireless updates in schools. I will transition into some items for the Center for Distance Education. I apologize, that slide does not read very well. But this is a graph of the increase in their enrollments from 2007 till today. And you can see that it's clearly their enrollments are going up. They're getting more North Dakota schools. They're getting to be more, nearly all of their courses are online. There's better courses. And I think schools are much more open to the flexibility. If they have a student who wants to take forensics, they don't offer it in their school. They can get that class at the Center for Distance Education at a very reasonable cost and give that student the opportunity. So that's North Dakota enrollments only. This chart compares it to the North Dakota enrollments to their total enrollments. So there's not only growth in state, there's growth out of state. And just a few reasons why we see that growth, I think on both angles is, again, back to those electives. Both schools in and out of state and homeschools want those opportunities to get elective courses. It's sometimes difficult to find highly qualified teachers. And as you know, we have a teacher shortage with all of the many teachers retiring. That fills a need. The center works with a handful of schools, being their math department or the English department due to a loss of a teacher. Just a summary of the enrollments. Sometimes people think that the Center for Distance Education is all about credit recovery. You'll see that that's one of their smaller areas. They have 193 enrollments. Their biggest enrollments are in core and elective classes. They have nearly 2,000 of those. They have a very high completion rate, 94%, and have really come around the last 3 years or so in dealing with the influx of so many online providers popping up all over the country, that kind of competition, and focusing on what schools in North Dakota need. Finally, a few slides about EduTech. Again, relating to PowerSchool, all schools in our state are on PowerSchool. We achieved that goal over a year ago. We still are implementing a private school or two here and there, and that team works a lot on the state longitudinal data system and e-transcript, which allows students' transcripts to be electronically transferred to colleges in-state at this point. We're working very closely with the department to help schools prepare for the Common Core online tests. Although schools have some experience in online testing, never with this particular one, so we've helped them inventory all of their devices, their proctors, their rooms, all of those things that they have available. We're helping them with some LAN assessments, because once you get a bunch of kids in a room and you start hitting those test servers, you may have some surprises, and we don't want them to have those surprises. We want them to be prepared. In preparation, we have about 114 buildings doing a field test this year, and it might be just a small sample of elementary students taking a math test, but it will be a good assessment for us to see how this online testing really works. Finally, as I spoke, ITD, EduTech, ETC, DPI, we all provide support to K-12. And typically, they've had a mishmash of places to contact. We've agreed at this point that EduTech will be the central contact point, and we'll be working to make sure that the customer always has just that one point of contact, but we'll channel tickets between our organizations to serve them best. A branch that EduTech has had is taking on more of DPI support. We're in progress with that right now. That is all the data that's required for title and ELL. So instead of a customer calling a person at the department to ask a specific question, they can call the help desk and get that item ticketed and channeled, or perhaps our help desk agent knows that answer and can help them explain where that piece of data goes and why it might go there. We've enhanced our support options, including chat and a new remote desktop viewing piece of software to better help customers. It's surprising how many people really would rather just pick up and chat with you than turn in an online ticket or send an email or give you a phone call. And of course, we're preparing support and training for Office 365. A little bit about our outreach. This is my last slide. We're trying to do some STEM projects, working with LA City State and NDSU, and also the Sanford Underground Research Facility, that's in South Dakota, to provide some enrichment activities for students. We sponsor a conference every year that's under the National Learning Forward umbrella, and we've tried to provide some additional professional development. Learning Forward provides standards for professional development. It describes how teachers should garner their professional development and give some standards, just like the standards we have for our students. EduTech has a large YouTube channel, and our goal there is to prepare tutorials and different pieces of information to self-serve. We have a good customer base that likes to help themselves, that wants to find something out via video. And of course, we still have the customer base that likes to call and maybe likes a little bit more hand-holding. The last thing I wanted to explain that's been kind of a piece of fire for us is, if you're familiar with Twitter, we have something every Wednesday night called North Dakota Ed Chat. And so that's when a group of teachers, if they want to expand their horizons a little bit, from 9 to 10 on Wednesday night, an EduTech staff person facilitates that. People get on Twitter, the facilitator poses 5 questions, 1 at a time. And we've had a lot of activity driven by that, and even a couple schools copying that model in their own district for professional development. So we consider that successful. And of course, we're trying to find ways to deliver professional development in ways that make sense to teachers and fits in with their lifestyle and the time they have available. That is all of the content I have for you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Miller.
Mr. Chairman, you mentioned that in the grant process, very few, only one Western school applied. Do you have any theories as to why?
Representative Wyvern and Senator Miller, I don't have anything scientific. I believe it's probably due to a lot of their workloads. With all the intense things I have with their growth and enrollment, they're just busy doing everything that they can every day to survive. And a grant takes leadership and time from staff to pull it together. In fact, the one from Billings County, we had to extend them a couple of days because of an emergency at that school that took place. And then, of course, with CenturyLink, those are only in CenturyLink locations, and I don't believe there's many in Western North Dakota.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess we'll move on to the higher ed.
Sheldon's going to help me pass stuff out.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Feldner, and I serve as a vice chancellor at the North Dakota University System. The first part of this I'll cover, which was on the agenda, and that is any updates to large projects that we have. And it is our IT office building, which we began moving in October and had the building dedication in November. As you may recall, we had staff in 5 to 6 different locations all over campus at UND, and they didn't collaborate or even get to know each other. And now they're in a brand new office building in somewhat in cubes. So we had a workshop entitled Who Moved My Cube? And it's designed to get employees acclimated to a different style of work. And some of the feedback that you'll see is that we got positive feedback wise is that they feel it's a privilege to work in this environment, and it really does promote teamwork and brainstorming conversations, we've seen as managers increased productivity. We don't have any data to support that, but we certainly view that we have increased productivity. They like the ability to collaborate and actually get to know the other members of the other employees. We have a cafeteria area, because we're encouraging people to get up from their cubes and go eat in the cafeteria area rather than eating at their desks. And of course, one of the things is great parking. We're very pleased with the building, and things are going very well. So we want to thank you for providing the funding for that. The next part of that project was the...
Lisa, before we go on, I know the committee has talked about going up there for a tour, but if we do it in June, is that...
That works.
That does work good for...
We have you marked down on the calendar, I think.
Oh, you do? Okay. We will talk about that later, but I just wanted to...
Absolutely. The next part of that project is the data center, and the construction is complete. We got our certificate of occupancy in January. We are now installing servers and network equipment and cabling, and then it has to go through what's called a burn-in. And what that means is when you first open some of this IT equipment up right out of the box and plug it in, sometimes the components, as you all know, how things don't always work, they can short circuit or whatever they do, or they burn, and sometimes power supplies will burn. So you put the equipment in before you start using it and let it have time to stabilize. So that's part of what's going on. We won't start putting data in there until we have everything installed, and then we'll start transferring data from the old data center over to this one. The projects are both within time variance, and they are under budget. One of the things that we're doing is ordering intrusion detection devices to sit on the outside of that data center, just as we have here at the Capitol, at ITD does. They're the same product that's used by ITD, and ITD has graciously offered to help us with a programming template to set those up. So we're very fortunate to have that expertise in state. So, and I'll talk about this, which wasn't on the agenda. And that you're probably all wondering about anyway. So what happened on February 7th was we had a breach of one of our servers. And I want you to look particularly at the metrics of this server, and there are almost 73,000 files on that server. And the reason that's fairly key is we've been criticized because it's taken us so long to come forward and say whether has your data been compromised or not. Well, when you're trying to look through 73,000 files, that takes a while. And we've had all hands on deck, all weekends, and so on to look. Now, the thing about these files is it's not a file with 300,000 social security numbers in it. It's one here with one, one over here with one. It's a PDF over here that's maybe somebody's transcripts. So it's been very laborious, to say the least. And that's why we are waiting till tomorrow to turn on the call center and the help desk for people to call in, because it's taken that long for you to be able to call in and say, this is my student ID or my name or whatever, has my data been compromised? And I'll go on a little bit and tell you more about that. The first thing we did was to shut down the server, I take it off the network and lock down the accounts. And to look to see was ConnectND accessed, and it was not. So that was crucial. This happened on a Friday, of course, so all of this was going on over the weekend. What happened was we had a user account that was compromised by malware, and the malware was a keystroke logger. So it logged all the keystrokes the individual was using. And out of that logging, of course it was transmitting it back to whoever the hacker was, they were able to figure out what the username and password was to this particular machine. And they hacked it. what we discovered, started to look at was he then hacked three more accounts, and those three accounts didn't really have any access to any of the sensitive information. So it was just the one individual account that we've been focusing on. On Monday, we had locked all the accounts. We enabled a couple of them that we knew had to use that server. The server is used to upload data into ConnectMD. So some critical functions do happen on that server. We increased the network security around the server, but we took away, there were 600 user accounts on that server, and we disabled all of them, and then re-enabled them one at a time as access permitted, which that is also, and I'll talk about that when we get to the prevention slide too. One of the things we needed was somebody to do third-party forensics. And I asked the system, the IT folks, do we have anyone that does third-party forensics? And the answer was, well, no, we've never had this before. So I called ITD, and thankfully Dan Sipes and Mike were wonderful, and getting, I knew that there was what's called the multi-state information sharing and analysis center, MSISAC. It's a cybersecurity compact between all the states, and they do this for states and federal agencies. And they were willing to take the server, a copy of the server, and do forensics on it for us. It took a little while. Once again, another reason this took a little while was we didn't have an agreement with them or a non-disclosure, so we had to get legal involved. But everybody expedited as much as possible. So that continued. What we had hoped was, we ourselves knew that there were about, there were the 290 plus thousand SSNs and student IDs on there. But we, from what we could see, the hacker did not access those files. I mean, but we also couldn't prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that he didn't. We know they didn't copy them. We know they didn't transmit them. We know they didn't make a copy of the server. We know all of those things. We just don't know if they happened to open a file. Maybe they opened a PDF and looked at it. We don't know that. And did they write down the social security number on a piece of paper? That's why we felt like we had to err on the side of caution and say, we better notify everyone and provide some kind of protection or credit recovery services. One of the important things and lessons that, I'm not going to say lessons learned because we had it in place. We had, I'm going to go back a slide, an incident response team. And that was critical. And procedures in place to say, what do we do in the case of a breach? And we followed our plan. We also called ITD and got their input. Dan Sipes was absolutely wonderful. I did, and I want to go to another piece of this. When I talked about those intrusion detection devices that we are putting on in front of our data center, I called Dan and said, can I get the logs from the network intrusion detection devices that you have at the state? And he said, well, Lisa, I can give them to you, but I don't know what good they're going to do because we don't monitor the university system network. Don't you remember? And I went, no, I forgot that part. I didn't realize in my former life that we weren't monitoring threat and doing threat prevention on the university system. So I asked them to give me a quote to size those boxes appropriately and what it will cost to put that on the internet links for the university system. Because one of the things those devices do is block malware upon entry into the state, in most cases, in some cases. I mean, you're not going to get it all. If in fact the laptop that was infected was over the internet, perhaps this would have been blocked. So that's what we are working on in terms of prevention, and I know I'm skipping around, but that's the way my mind is working today. We were waiting for MSISAC to come back and confirm that they felt also that we didn't, that the hackers didn't access any of the accounts, but they we're still working. So we went, as many of you know, I called you and said that we had this incident, and then we notified the governor and the board, the university presidents, many of you. And we had our press conference on Wednesday of that week and notified the public. And then, and we've been going on daily basis with trying to take calls and referring them to the call center that will go live tomorrow at 8 a.m. When I talked about that incident response team, one of the most valuable people on the team is your public relations person, because they understand how to communicate with the public. Linda Donlin is here, and she's just been absolutely invaluable. And so if we get to the call center part and you have questions, she might have to answer them for you, because she's been key in helping us get that set up. How much does it cost? It's not cheap. We have we chose a vendor in all of this, and we like this vendor better because they have what are called credit recovery services rather than credit monitoring, which doesn't really serve you that well. I mean, you can monitor your own credit, and we have in our FAQs on our website, we, you know, encourage people to do that. But in the event that your identity is, or your information is compromised, they will help you recover. That's what the service is. So we felt that was a better service than just credit monitoring. They have a year of coverage, and that part costs $87,000, as you can see. And our call center service is good for 90 days, and that's the more expensive part. Of course, then the next cost that we are just starting to estimate is we've gotten several open records requests from media for all of our emails, and there's a lot of redaction that has to take place because people are emailing us and saying, this is when I graduated, this is my name, can you look up to see, am I part of this? Well, we can't release that. So that's one of the costs. This bottom one is the one I just talked about, working on the intrusion detection devices with ITD. You want to ask a question before I go on to prevention? I can see.
Well, I suppose we can take a break here and ask questions. One question I have, Lisa, is, you know, questions have come to me is, granted your initial information was that there probably wasn't any access to those SSNs and stuff, but question came, why did you not release this information earlier so people could take some steps on their own to put, you know, monitor their credit history or whatever? I mean, that's some of the questions that have been raised to me, is why it took you roughly a month before you made the public announcement. I mean, I understand it takes time to do your call center and that they put in place, but just that the public can know there was at least a possibility. So if you could respond.
Yeah, in fact, I'm glad you said that, because that was one of the things we kept agonizing over, that because our forensics showed that they probably didn't access things, and we didn't want to go out there and say, oh, you know, be careful, we think we lost 300,000 social security number, were breached, and then come back 2 weeks later and say, oh, just kidding. Because then we thought, well, then we really look stupid, because that's really the way it's turning out, by the way. We had to wait for MSISAC to come back, because we really felt that third party, and that's their job, that's what they do, is do forensics on these types of things. We were hoping they could come back quicker to tell us the same thing. And unfortunately, that took longer than we had anticipated, and they didn't get back to us to say that, in fact, they don't believe that those files were accessed either. Now, after our press conference and after all the things that we released. I think probably after Friday when everything goes live, and we'll probably go back and have a debrief and say, well, how could we do this better? You know, how could we release it sooner? I mean, we knew when we were releasing it that we were behind. There's no question. So, yeah.
Senator Robinson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lisa, thanks for the update. You know, I think when we hear about breach efforts that are underway across the country and the recent Target situation, there's just more and more of these happening. I'm just of the opinion that we should look at this latest incident as an opportunity for us to leverage our systems and analyze what improvements we might make that otherwise would have been much more difficult to do. So maybe in the next couple of months before we meet again, it might be wise for us if, I know I talked to Adam earlier, if we had an analysis of our state system and the university system side by side. And it's an opportunity for the state system, Mike and his people, to take another look at what we're doing and where can we tighten things up even more. And certainly for the university system to see what we might do as a system that would put us more in line with what is in place with this state system. I think it's just an opportunity that we can do some things now that a month ago would have been more difficult to accomplish. So it's incumbent on us to seize the moment, learn from this situation, and it's really a situation where you look across the country, it's not if you're going to be hacked, it's when. And so hopefully the damage, if you will, has been minimized, but to the extent we learn and make the system that much better, we'll be better for it. So one, it'd be nice for the next meeting if we had an analysis of where are we at, compare the two. And maybe there's room for improvement in both sides of the equation. And if that's the case, if it requires legislation, we should know about that. If there's some things we can do administratively, we should move and make those changes. But it'd be nice to have that on the agenda for our June meeting if we're going to meet in Grand Forks.
Representative Thorson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lisa, I appreciate the report. I will tell you, representing a district where I join a university and have a lot of students and quite a few former students and a lot of employees of the university system there, probably more than anything in the last several years, this has raised a lot of concern by people, and I've been getting phone calls and emails about it. And so I guess I have a couple of questions. You said there were about 290,000 records accessed. Was that correct? Or I don't know.
That's how many were on the server.
How many were on the server?
We don't believe that any of them were.
Okay, but that was how many were on there. Questions that I'm getting are, were there non-academic type information, say employee records, people who work for the university system that might have been accessed, or I won't say accessed, but were available possibly on that server?
892 faculty and staff.
Okay. And former students also, is that correct? Do we know how, going back how long of a period of time that would be?
That I don't know yet.
You don't know. Okay.
But not, our best, they probably know by today, but I think the best estimate is 2004.
Okay. Another question was, and I know this may be a stretch, but any health records? I mean, sometimes there's interaction with the university system and having to have health records, would that have been anything that you're aware of would be on there?
Check that very carefully.
Okay.
And that the answer is those, what was on there were not considered health records and they were not compromised.
Okay. And then the other big question I've been getting is why was this not more secure? Why was it not encrypted? Is there any information on that? Because I guess that's one that I can't answer and need to have an answer to people when I go back and say, if I have all this information of mine out there, especially as Senator Robinson said in the air of what happened with Target, and you know, in the Valley we've been dealing with phone calls at 3 a.m. from someone saying your credit card has been accessed and a lot of other things, and then this pops up, people are interested in knowing why wasn't my information locked down a little tighter.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thorson, I'm glad you asked that question. We looked at the policy that was there, and the folks that were in charge of that server were following policy. The data was encrypted in transit. And it was, the policy doesn't state it has to be encrypted at rest, which means when it's sitting on the server. And I know that Valley News Live is maybe portraying that the other way. So the individuals were following policy. However, that doesn't mean that's the best policy that, and that's why on my second bullet on this slide, we're reviewing those things. So yes. Now, in some cases, when even when data is encrypted at rest, if a person, if a hacker gets into the right kind of account, it really doesn't matter if it's encrypted at rest because they can open it anyway because they've compromised a user account.
Right, and I understand that, but I think it's still
right
to the end user, the people that aren't the technology people, they think there may be at least, and there does seem to be some additional level of security there. It might take that hacker a little more to get to the information if they truly want to get to it. And Mr. Chairman, if I might, just one last thing. You talked about the time frame. I guess that's been the one big thing that people are saying is, why did it take so long? And going forward, I would hope we never have this situation again, but if we do, you know, maybe an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Lisa, just kind of running your math here, you said there are about 10 years worth of information, and yet you have almost 300,000 SSNs on there?
I did the same thing.
The math doesn't seem to add up.
Didn't add up to me either. And so I'm still waiting for the answer to
it. You know, and I guess one of the questions I would have, is it necessary to be keeping, you know, and we're talking about security and protecting all that, but is it necessary to even have those records on that server anymore, all of them, you know?
Mr. Chairman, you are absolutely correct. And we wiped all data from that server, and it is wiped now on a 14-day interval. So any file that reaches 15 days old is wiped from the server. It is all gone now. So you are correct. That was not being properly done.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Miller?
Lisa, one question I just had is, how many people have a level of access that can, you know, give a hacker broad access to the system?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, we're not that many, and we're reviewing those right now. That's my other bullet here, third bullet is, we're reviewing all those access levels for everyone on all the various systems and tightening those down.
And one other question, is there any hope to find out where this originated from? I would imagine that really determines what they're looking for.
Yes, we have, we're in touch with the FBI. DCI has a copy of the affected drive, and they are doing forensics on the user's drive, the one that had the malware on it. And Highway Patrol has been involved, and there's it's an ongoing investigation. So I don't know when we'll know the answer, but there's three law enforcement very heavily involved.
Representative Watt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Lisa, for the update. And Representative Thorson, I think, really, you know, asked a lot of the appropriate questions, and you know, just 72 miles north from Representative Thorson's district, you know, I've got that similar situation where so many of my constituents are the ones that, they're not the number, they're the people behind the number that have been affected by the security breach. The more I think about this, the more distraught I become by the situation. I don't want my position here on this committee to reflect back too much. I want to focus forward, but there's a lot of questions that have to be answered. And I think those will come out here, I'm hoping, sooner rather than later. Just a couple that I don't want to go after back after everything that's already been asked and addressed, but there's a couple that is still lingering in my mind. And one is there a two-step verification process for anyone who has access to this level of server? It's not just a username and password, but an additional verification that you need in order to access that to prevent a malware from keystroke copying to be able to access this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mock, no, we're still working on multi-factor, but that is in the plan.
Okay.
So yes, that is very much on the top of our radar.
Okay. And you had mentioned, and I think we're, so it was the previous screen to this one, the cost associated with this, and the identity theft protection coverage. Am I correct to assume that everyone who will be notified tomorrow that their information was located on this server, that they will be automatically enrolled in this one-year identity theft protection coverage?
I believe they have to call and request it. No? Okay, they are. Okay, sorry.
Okay, so they will be automatically, okay, that's a good, I'm glad that's the case. Will there be because I'd like to think that 1 year of coverage would help, you know, any major incident that would arise from an SSN theft, but is there an option for an individual to have that coverage extended beyond the 365 days? Either in share between cost of the individual and the university, but I mean, is there a plan for that?
Yeah, I can check. I'll check and get back.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Torres.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If they're automatically enrolled, are they also then automatically notified that they've been enrolled in the service, or is that something which they need to reach out to determine?
You want to come?
Maybe.
Yes, thank you. We are notifying.
Could you state your name?
My name is Linda Donlin. I'm the Director of Communications and Media Relations for the University Service. And we are notifying everyone for whom we have good email addresses. We've been working also with alumni associations and things to check on current email addresses. So then we're relying on our public outreach to get the number out there, the call number for the call center. So if people have not been notified, if they're still wondering if they're part of the group, that they can call the call center and they have all that information. They can let the caller know if they're on the list or not. And then at that same number, if they notice something within the next year, they call that call center number, and then they will be assigned an investigator, and the person will help them with the identity repair if they have a problem.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the primary way of notifying is via email, is that correct?
That's correct. And all of our public outreach through the media.
I guess if there's any, I mean, if you don't have a valid email address, I suppose you may not have a valid postal address also, but if there is something like that, I think some kind of a mail notification would be very helpful to people also, especially in a situation where electronic data has been compromised. To use that as the primary way of informing them, I think might, I'm a big believer, obviously, in technology, but I think in this case it might, physical hard copy of something saying here's what to do step by step might not be the worst thing either.
Any further questions as long as Linda's up? Representative Owens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious now that all this has come up after identity theft and being included automatically and all. I find it hard to believe this company is going to say, okay, because this has happened, identity theft's happened, something's happened. Let's say for me, okay, all of a sudden I have something that I don't believe is mine and all this other stuff, and I was in the group and I was part of this. Their agreement includes some type of proof that it was caused by this event before they participate and make good? Or is that part of the investigation? And if they can't prove it, because that's one of the hardest things about identity theft is proving what caused identity theft to begin with.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Owens, my understanding is that they are automatically protected for this year. The investigation does not go to the extent where it'll try to figure out if it was part of this or something else, but it will help them repair their identity and anything that's happened. So, I mean, it could have been that they were part of the target thing, but because they're on our list, they're automatically covered.
Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to, some of the other universities that have been hit recently are Stanford, Indiana U, the University of Maryland, University of South Carolina, UC Berkeley, Delaware, and most recently Johns Hopkins. And so the things that we've been reading, and part of the reason that universities are being targeted is there's a lot of information in university systems. And so that appears to be what hackers are after these days. Now, in the Johns Hopkins case, the hackers got a hold of some information and then tried to extort from the university to say, we've got this personal information and we won't publish it if you pay us. Tried to blackmail them, and Johns Hopkins said no. And so they published it. But it was a small number. It was like 900, I think, users. But it just kind of the world we're living in right now.
Well, you're saying we're an esteemed company?
Yeah. Isn't that great?
Not sure that's the esteemed company I want to be in.
No, me either.
Okay.
Well, that's not what I wanted. So just going back over the prevention things, we're going to, ITD is going to help us with threat prevention and intrusion detection on our internet links. We're reviewing our security policies and procedures, as I said, very carefully. And doing a very thorough review of and restricting user access down to what, re-reviewing what their access is and should they have that kind of access to whatever systems those are. We're going to create a cross-functional security team, which will be the security officer from each campus, as well as our security team at NDUS, myself, and Darren King, our deputy CIO. We are, of course, going over things with our staff on enhancing awareness. And one of the things that was going on prior to this is we have an endpoint task force studying how can we be more secure with all the mobile devices that are on our campuses. And right now, our survey came back and said that 46% of all students do their work on their own multiple devices. So probably a laptop and a smartphone, or could be a tablet and a laptop. I mean, those kinds of things. So only 29% use their own device primarily, but also use one of the campus's labs. And only 9% of students use campus technology only. And this was, of course, a survey of students, so it's not all students. I mean, not all of them responded, but I think it's a representative sample. Faculty and staff, about 42% just use the university's equipment, but 44% now, and this has grown, are using both their own devices and the university's. And in those cases, they're bringing, you know, tablets or smartphones, and that their own personal devices. So how do we secure the network and our data centers, our resources from mobile devices that bring malware, let's say, onto campus? So that task force is working busily, and they will recommend a solution for us. I'm trying to think. You know, I skipped around in this so much I don't remember what I've forgotten. So this is the call center that goes live tomorrow at 8. And the website that we have had all of the frequently asked questions, that has been up since the beginning. And anyone can go there, and then you will be referred to the call center or wherever. And any other questions? I can...
Any further questions? Representative Tonnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lisa, you mentioned that this is a user account attack, and we're focused on that now. Now that it's public, there's other types of attacks that are probably going to be launched. So are you guys looking into that? As part of this study, are we closing those loopholes? Are we prepared for being attacked when we're weak?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tolman, thank you for bringing that up, because that was one of the things I forgot. Yes, when evildoers read these types of things in newspapers, then they try and capitalize on the problem. So we have seen an increase in phishing. Well, we don't know if it's related to this or not, but what we've said to our CIOs is beware, because there may be an increase in phishing attacks on your users, you know, and anything related to that. So we also, and the other piece to this is, with open records and everything, people are saying, well, we want all your email related to this incident. Well, that's fine, except there's a certain line that you have to draw to say no, because we don't want the evildoers to find out what is the layout of our infrastructure, what servers contain what information. We don't, that is not, that is very bad for your security posture. So yes, we're aware of all those things, and you know, it's a fine line between what does the public get to know and what needs to stay secure. Well, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
That's a question. Okay. Any further questions? Seeing not, thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
I think committee will take a 5-minute break before we start the large projects reporting.
Do you guys? Oh, do you? I thought it was whoever was behind me.
Hey, let's bring the committee back to order. Okay, we'll continue on our agenda, and we'll move into the large information technology projects. And you're on.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Molesworth, Project Oversight Analyst for the Information Technology Department, and I bring you good news.
And I bring you good news.
Thank you.
And we wanted to hear that part on the record, at least.
So we kind of are in a rut with large project oversight reporting. We go through the cover letter. I tell you about this big, thick document if you want to read it later. We talk about these big, giant projects. Since we have people who come and talk about those anyway, I wanted to do things just a little bit different with the same amount of time. I want to start out on the back of the cover letter, where it says, of the remaining 14 active projects, 13 were reported as green and one as yellow. And talk about what's really going good with projects right now. So if I could direct you to this larger document, and we're going to skip over the ones that are on the cover letter because we'll talk about those in a little bit. But there's a lot of projects that don't get a lot of recognition that do wonderful things for our constituents and the agencies, the citizens of the state, that are complex, hard to accomplish, lots of people working hard, and they're pulling these off, making it look like it's easy when it's not. And I just want to cover some of those. PeopleSoft Recruiting Solutions with the Office of Management and Budget just went live. We're going to be able to now electronically emulate things that other agencies and organizations have done for years, like Monster.com, where you can recruit and do your resume and your application and everything else online. If you want to come work for the state of North Dakota, we're going to be able to aggregate some of those numbers and make it easier to get a job here with the state. On the next page, billing system rewrite, you'll see that there is a startup report for you to look at. For me, a real good example of taking the time necessary to plan correctly so that you only have to execute once. We're in execution now. That project, again, green. The state longitudinal data system. Now, this one doesn't show up on the cover letter because we have a $5 million threshold for that, but we're talking $4,700,000. You seldom hear anything about it. It was big news a few years ago when we started this initiative. Continues to go well, again, green. Taxpayer access point, again, more online access for taxpayers to do their business. $1 million, green. The state longitudinal education data system working, again, this is public instruction working with the other longitudinal data system, as well as e-transcripts, all making it more possible to share information, access information, green and green. The Women's, Infants, and Children's Electronic Benefits Transfer, that's a study for what will be a major project in a year or two if the federal government continues down the path of electronic benefits transfer. Again, green. The Veterans Home Electronic Medical Records, they are doing the same thing that the large hospitals and the large EMR providers are doing in implementing a new system to provide electronic health records, lab records, etc., as well as being able to recoup $200,000 a month in reimbursements that go to the benefit of our veterans that completed this month and will be reported next quarter as completed, and again, green. The Department of Human Services Vocational Rehabilitation Information System replacement, a total replacement to manage caseloads for voc rehab, that again is coming to a close pretty soon, and green. North Dakota Verify kind of gets swallowed up by some of the other Department of Human Services things, but deals with the Children's Health Information Program, SNAP and TANF, that you'll see has closed, and you'll have a closeout report to see that that was also green. Job Service WDQI, green. Bank of North Dakota, Cash Plus, more online abilities, green. The statewide seamless base map, talked a lot about that. Again, not making the $5 million cutoff, but $2 to $3.5 million project that's going to do wonderful things as far as mapping all the GIS work that goes on in the state. Green going to be completed in the near future as well. And then you heard from the Department of Commerce on their website, Rewrite, also Green. So I just wanted to take that time and very quickly call your attention to those projects, and hopefully you'll go back and take a little closer look at some of them. They don't make the $5 million cutoff to come to the front. Sometimes the ones that are over $5 million on the front look yellow and sometimes red. But I mentioned three or four that were $4.75 million or above that every month or every quarter we report on that are going well. And I just wanted to make sure that we called out to your attention. So quickly with the rest of my time, I will just start with the front page of the cover letter, which indicates two more projects that completed in the past quarter, the ND Verify, which I discussed, as well as Bank of North Dakota. Both of them show green on budget and schedule. Both of them completed under budget. ND Verify was within schedule variance, and the Cash Plus project on schedule. We do have five projects in the planning stage, just to give you a brief on those. Statewide Records Management started planning recently. The Department of Human Services Operating Rules is still in planning, somewhat on hold as we make decisions moving forward, and you may hear more about that later this morning. The WIC Management Information System upgrade will soon be going into execution. StageNet Transport, you've heard testimony on that in previous meetings. And then WICAN, the Wyoming, Colorado, Arizona, North Dakota UI Consortium, that is going to be a major project and get more close reporting as it moves into execution, which will be in the first quarter's report that you receive in the next reporting period. They'll be in execution. We did move through projects from planning to execution, billing system rewrite, which has a startup report, recruiting solutions, which has since completed, and you'll be seeing a closeout report in the next reporting period, and the taxpayer access point. So that brings us to the Department of Human Services Eligibility System Modernization and Medicaid Systems projects. I'm not going to read those to you directly. You will be receiving testimony on the MMIS project. So I will conclude that portion of my testimony and be open to any questions you may have.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? I guess not. Great. Thanks for the report. Appreciate some of the positives.
Thank you.
When we're getting beat up some days.
And there's a lot of hard work going on behind the scenes. I just want to make sure all those people that are working on those projects get recognized, because sometimes only the tough projects get the notice. So thank you for taking the time. Project startup and close-up reports. I'll just repeat the process that we're using, which is to provide you with electronic access to those reports. We used to bring each one of them up individually regardless and have them present. Now, if you see something in reviewing those reports that you would like to have them come back, please let us know. We'll make an appointment to have them appear at the next meeting. There are a small number this time. The billing system rewrite, which I mentioned, is a startup report, immunization information system, enhanced interoperability, and ND Verify. Now, if we think that there are some great lessons learned that should be shared with the group, or something that you've been following and interested in as they close out, or a really good success story and we want to make sure that it comes to light, we will make recommendations that they do in-person presentations of that. And in this case, of the three, the Department of Health with their Immunization Information System Enhanced Interoperability Project, which works very closely with the Health Information Network and feeds that immunization information to them as well as others, has asked to share their success stories. So right after the presentation from the Department of Human Services, we'll ask Kirby Kruger to come up and provide some testimony on their closeout report and provide you with some of the metrics. And that is all of my testimony, and I would be open for any questions.
Okay. Thank you. It appears thank there's you. No questions. Okay. I believe Jenny, I suppose.
Thank you.
Chairman Weiss and members of the Information Technology Committee, I'm Jenny Witham, Director of the Information Technology Services for the Department of Human Services, and I appear before you to provide an update on the status of the Medicaid Systems Project. DHS is working with our primary vendor, Xerox Corporation, on a revised work plan for the completion of the project, and at this time, we are targeting a September 2014 implementation. Xerox recently completed the system integration testing by resolving all critical and high defects. DHS staff is continuing to execute user acceptance testing. For UAT, all the functional area test cases must be executed with a 90% pass rate. Failed test cases cannot have open defects with severity or high of critical or high, and failed test cases cannot have any more than 10% of a defect severity for moderate. The tables on the next page outline the SIT and UAT test progress to date. In addition to system integration testing and user acceptance testing, multiple testing activities are underway and planned for the remainder of the pre-implementation period. These include data conversion testing, end-to-end testing, performance testing, 508 ADA or compliance testing, interface testing, trading partner and electronic data exchange testing, operational readiness testing, and parallel testing. I'm not going to walk through the numbers on the following page, on page 2, but just to point out that system integration testing is complete. The fact that there are no critical or high defects, and the pass rate is within compliance. The user acceptance testing, we've been rolling it out in packages, as I had discussed last time. And we had started the first package in June, and we have just recently started package 4. And the package 4 has most of the claims processing functions, and we're continuing to work through those. But a lion's share has of the functionality has gone through user acceptance testing. The reason why none of the packages have been approved or met the exit criteria is because of the level of the critical or high defects that are still outstanding, but I have those the numbers there for you so you can get an idea of the size of those defects. The following table outlines the project expenditures through the month of January. The budget was $81.9 million. As I discussed last time in my December testimony, we had requested to the Emergency Commission additional federal authority to add functionality that will help us through the completion to the end date. A lot of that has to do with the additional testing and training supports that we had identified. That was approved, so the revised budget then is $88.5 million. Our expenditures through the month of January have been $57.4 million, with a remaining amount of authority of 31.1. We are in the process of securing approval from the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid Services. We did receive our approval letter late yesterday, so we'll be going through that with the Executive Steering Committee and looking at some of the conditions that they put on it. And so we're ready to move forward because we did receive that approval. And if you have any questions, I would be happy to address them at this time.
Jenny, how's your at least estimated, I guess, date here going to be affected or affect the change from the ICD-9 to the ICD-10? Is that going to be, because that's due October?
It's October 2014, so we would be going live in advance of that.
And you're confident that that'll happen, or are you still making provisions in case it doesn't happen, or?
Chairman Weiss and members of the committee, we are still making provisions to have a fallback plan in case we miss that date.
Okay, so there isn't any indication that CMS would extend that date for you?
Representative Weiss, or Chairman Weiss and members of the committee, I do not believe that CMS has the intent to move that date. And I don't know, Maggie, do you?
Yeah. Okay. Any further questions from the committee? I guess you're getting off easy today. You've been here too much, I guess, is the problem. Okay, Kirby?
morning, Chairman Wise and members of the Information Technology Committee. For the record, my name is Kirby Kruger. I'm the Director of the Division of Disease Control with the North Dakota Department of Health. Today, I want to take some time to summarize our closeout report for our project, the NDIIS interoperability project. You'll have two documents in front of you. One is my summary testimony, and then the other one is the actual report. So, the North Dakota Immunization Information System is a confidential, population-based, computerized information system that collects data about all North Dakotans, that attempts to collect data on all North Dakotans. NDIIS, as we call it, is an important tool to increase and sustain vaccination levels and coverage by consolidating vaccination records of children from multiple providers, providing immunization rate reports and providers in official immunization forms. The goal of this project was to increase interoperability between NDIIS and various electronic health records within North Dakota throughout the state. Interoperability has improved the completeness of immunization histories available to clinicians and public health by ensuring that all vaccine doses administered are maintained in a registry and reported in a timely manner. Interoperability has also reduced duplicate data entry for providers who have successfully connected to the NDIIS. In terms of budget and schedule, the original baseline schedule for this project was at 24 months. It was a federal 24-month grant. However, it was quickly realized that the technical requirements of the NDIS system exceeded the capabilities of the most advanced electronic health records that were in North Dakota. Subsequently, the state asked for and received a no-cost one-year extension of that grant to complete the originally planned integration with the state's highest volume immunization providers. Based upon the approved baseline changes and strategies, decision to extend the project an additional month, the final baseline variance for our scheduling was a negative 8.3% by extending by that month. The grant budget of $620,000 was not fully expended during the project time frame. However, when accounting for the planned scope that was completed, a positive variance of 2.5% was achieved in the budget. Some highlights. To comply with the grant requirements, the North Dakota Department of Health needed to increase the number of bi-directional electronic health record NDIIS practice-based connections available. There were no interfaces that were in existence at the time of this when we started. While simultaneously increasing the number of real-time practice-based electronic immunization transactions reported to NDIIS each week. The health systems below that were included in the project represent 119 provider practices, and they were Altrue in Grand Forks, Trinity in Minot, Essentia, Fargo, Sanford, Fargo, Sanford, Bismarck, and then the North Dakota Health Information Network. The baseline for electronic submissions was zero because when we started the project, nobody was submitting to us electronically. Post-project, 56.5% of the transactions reported came to NDIS electronically. Some success stories here. Duplicate data entry savings. By far the most beneficial element, at least from the provider level of interoperability, was the elimination of duplicate data entry for provider participants. Due to existing state law, the collection of immunizations for children is required in the existing system, NDIS system, was a custom built to provide high data quality and safeguards. However, the providers began to adopt their own electronic health records. There was a lack of interoperability, and they were forced to do double data entry, both into their electronic health record and into NDIIS. Data collected during the fourth quarter of 2013 indicates the participating provider in total submitted an average of 76,375 messages per month using an average wage of $28 and a 60 to 90 cent second per immunization model. Participating providers have been able to save between $35,643 and $53,463 per month, and you can see the annual totals maybe up to $641,566 per year across the state. Based on the final actual cost, the investment on return will be realized in 11 to 16 and a half months. As we onboard additional providers, these savings will actually continue to grow. Adult immunizations. State law does not require the submission of adult immunizations into NDIS. Therefore, the decision to submit them to the registry was left to individual providers. Due to interoperability, all vaccinations that go into an electronic health record now get transferred over to NDIS. So now NDIS is beginning to collect adult immunization data on a more regular basis. The percentage of North Dakota adults with at least one dose of vaccine in NDIS increased from 72.7% in 2012 to 80% in 2013. The North Dakota Health Information Network. At the onset, it was understood that the process of creating interoperability would be costly and time-consuming, and the project progressed, it became evident that the cost of maintaining the multiple interoperability connections and resources needed from both business and technical staff would increase substantially and remain long after the temporary federal grant was expended. As the NDIS does not receive a state fund to operate, the project team conducted a sustainability planning exercise. One of the most promising outcomes was the relationship that the NDIS has built with the North Dakota Health Information Network. As a result, a single interoperability transport was built between NDIS and the North Dakota HIN to pass HL7 messages. The majority of existing interoperability connections and all future connections to provide will be routed through the North Dakota HIN and subsequently passed to the immunization registry. The HIN will assume responsibility for the primary connection to each provider, and NDIS will support new connections with testing and technical expertise. This alleviates the workload on the Department of Health to maintain multiple direct connections with providers, and an added bonus of this relationship is that it will that providers who are not connected to NDIS but are connected to the HIN will have the ability to gain access to patient immunization records using the HIN query capability. And I do believe Mr. Wolf showed that to you earlier in the day. So fully bi-directional real-time transactions, this is another win for us. State law was instrumental in motivating both providers and vendors to submit vaccination data real-time and bi-directionally at a time when both are faced with multiple priorities. Some of the lessons learned, onboarding exercise. As a result of a pilot testing with a single health system and subsequent lessons learned exercise, the project team developed a detailed onboarding process. The process involved the development of a system to automatically test electronic messages from providers for compatibility with NDIS. Feedback was then sent back to the provider regarding the transport and message errors that needed to be corrected. Another lesson learned was a condensed NDIS specification guide. At the onset of the project, North Dakota was one of only three states to utilize the vaccines for children coding and reporting requirements. VFC is a national program for vaccines for children that may not otherwise be able to afford vaccinations. This greatly complicated the interoperability efforts since all vendor EHRs were certified by the Centers for Disease Control, but VFC was not a requirement at that certification, therefore was not included as a base functionality in the EHR. Due to the complexity of the CDC and ND North Dakota specification guides, many of the technical representatives who participated in the original onboarding process did not recognize these deficiencies in their product until midstream in the interoperability effort. This resulted in long delays and complicated development efforts on the part of the vendor to bring the electronic health records into compliance with additional North Dakota specifications. As a result, the NDIS project team created a condensed specification guide identifying only those additional specifications required by North Dakota, but not by CDC, and bolstered the onboarding process to include early identification of the vendor's capabilities to meet those requirements. Another success story is our national recognition. Based on an abstract submitted to the Public Health Information Network Conference, representatives of the North Dakota Department of Health Immunization Program have been invited to present at a national conference to promote the use of onboarding standards and practices related to immunization interoperability. The Department of Health Immunization Program previously spoke about NDIS interoperability initiatives at the American Immunization Registry Association and the North Dakota Public Health Association. In conclusion, the Department of Health and the project officer for the Centers for Disease Control consider this project to be highly successful in not only completing the specified objectives, but in doing so in strict compliance with originally defined parameters of the ERA grant. It is our understanding that few, if any, other states have both achieved the objectives and done so within the expectations of the fully bidirectional real-time interface. The immunization staff will continue to pursue additional interoperability connections with provider practices in North Dakota and with the North Dakota Health Information Network to onboard potential candidates for interoperability as they are identified. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Kirby. Question I have, and I mean your numbers are good. You went from 0 to 56.2, so that's obviously good. But as you look going forward, what's, you know, you've got the vast majority of the providers, it looks like, are already in here. What's it going to take to get that number to be closer to 100? Is it just a matter of time, or are there some other issues yet that will have to be overcome? For example, non-acceptance by some of the providers or whatever.
Chairman Wise and committee members, that's a very good question. I think there are several challenges in moving forward. Number one of is we're not getting information from local public health departments because they don't have systems that are in place that can generate a message to us, and so that's going to take some time. I know that the local public health departments, many of them are implementing systems right now, and some of the smaller ones are starting to implement a system that will be able to do this, so I think that's just a matter of time. Number two, we're not collecting information from Indian Health Services right now because their system is not ready to send messages as well, and so we're just waiting for them to catch up on the technology side of that. The third part of that is there are a lot of smaller providers out there that we believe, just a matter of time, and Sheldon can correct me if I'm wrong here, before they'll be able to connect through the HIN. And that's what we're hoping that will happen, is that as the HIN develops, these providers will be able to connect through the HIN. So.
And Mr. Chairman, since you asked the question, if I can just add to that, I think the other thing is strictly a cost issue, because when we start building the HL interfaces, working with the providers that are out there, we're seeing anywhere from $5,000 to $25,000 to $30,000 to start building those connections. So it really becomes a cost issue for some of these really small providers too to be able to get on board. So I think that is one other thing that is out there. And, you know, Kirby mentioned it when he was going through his stuff, that cost is an issue, and it's something that we're going to have to work with you guys to address as we move forward with the HIN.
Okay. Any further questions? If not, all right. Thank you, Kirby. Thanks. Appreciate it. Okay, I guess we're ready to go on our 1040 agenda, high-speed internet.
Chairman Weiss and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dina Weezy. I'm the Executive Director of the Information Technology Council of North Dakota. Just want to thank you for the opportunity to provide an update on the Dakota Fiber Initiative that's being championed by ITC&D. I had filled you in December on the background kind of the initiative, but wanted to remind you of the objective, the fact that it's the objective is to provide affordable, world-class internet speed and reliability to every individual in the state of North Dakota. And although North Dakota has significant bandwidth coverage across the state, initial discussions point to the issues of inadequate speed, affordability of adequate speed, and then assurance that capacity can meet future needs. Both broadband supply and demand data does currently exist, but there's a need to compile all of that information, identify gaps in coverage, and then address the affordability issues as well. The Dakota Fiber Initiative is a statewide initiative focused on broadband policy and also assessment. From the policy end, we're going to work to create a favorable environment for expansion of affordable broadband services statewide. And in terms of the assessment, we're going to approach it in three geological phases. Pilot one being the Fargo, West Fargo area. Pilot two, addressing other urban areas in the state. And then finally, a statewide analysis. And ITC&D is a coordinating entity on both the supply and demand side of the initiative. Since updating your committee in December, several steps have been initiated and many are ongoing. Pledges have been secured for phase one of the initiative, which includes broadband supply and demand assessments in the Fargo and West Fargo area. An advisory committee meeting with those contributing to the initiative was held on January 23rd, and action steps from that meeting include moving forward with a RFP for a lit building map of Fargo and West Fargo to determine the supply of broadband services. And that was issued February 24th, and then the closing date on that will be in mid-March. And the second action step was an RFP to identify broadband demand and economic impact in that area, and that's currently being developed. Gary Ingman, the ITC&D president, also provided a presentation to the North Dakota 2020 and Beyond Technology Infrastructure Committee on January 23rd. And for those of you that are unfamiliar with that initiative, North Dakota 2020 and Beyond was commissioned by the 2011 legislature and is a joint initiative between the governor, the North Dakota Chamber, and the North Dakota Economic Development Foundation. The Technology Infrastructure Committee is tasked with identifying steps that should be taken by the state of North Dakota to grow technology infrastructure within the state and become a model for connectivity. So they had invited Gary to present on the Dakota Fiber Initiative, recognizing that our goals were very similar. Action steps for the Dakota Fiber Initiative from that meeting included defining the problem, both broadband supply and need, which we're currently working towards. Marketing the initiative, looking at getting information out to the public. Researching policy initiative options to ensure future construction is fiber ready. And so options that we're currently exploring are making permanent or extending the sales and use tax exemption for equipment used in telecommunications infrastructure. And then also using the current Renaissance Zone program, or developing a wire zone program that may have a similar structure to the Renaissance Zones programs, which have been successful. Developing a state program for urban areas similar to the federal program used for rural broadband build-out. That was very successful in the rural areas in North Dakota. Potentially pursuing legislation to require a conduit to be part of infrastructure development when new roads or bridges are built in communities. And again, these are just options we're exploring. None of these have, we haven't determined, yes, this is what we're going to move forward with, but we're just looking into those options. A demonstration was also hosted by Dakota Carrier Network in Fargo on February 28th to showcase how different bandwidth capacities impact the user experience. More than 20 stakeholders attended that demonstration, and we hope to be able to provide it to this committee as well at a time in the future that would work for you. Upon completion of the supply and demand assessments for Fargo and West Fargo, the advisory committee will recommend next steps based on the results. Discussions will be facilitated with appropriate stakeholders to address gaps identified with the intent of finding cost-effective solutions for those areas. ITC&D will also be researching the policy incentives that I had just touched on briefly to determine which may be the most effective to incentivize fiber rollout in the gaps, which would be identified through the broadband assessments. We will then begin looking at Pilot 2, which would be other urban areas across the state, and which would identify gaps in those areas, and then moving on to Phase 3, which would be statewide. So in summary, thank you again for the opportunity to update you. We'd welcome the opportunity to provide the broadband capability demo at a future date, and any input you have regarding this initiative would be greatly appreciated and welcomed. Also included in your in my testimony is the broadband comparisons you had requested. I just wanted to point out a couple things on there. The source for this is Ookla Net Index, and it's known as the largest and most comprehensive source of broadband data globally. It is subjective. It captures real-time user information. It's indicative of services purchased from those completing the speed test on the Ookla website, but it's not indicative of all services that are available in those areas. The faster speeds we know are available in those communities. So I did just want to point out those couple things. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Deanna. Is there any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you.
Great.
Anyone else wish to testify? Okay. Seeing none, then we'll move on to the 11 o'clock agenda. Results of the hardware relocation consolidation study. Pam?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pam Sharp with the Office of Management and Budget. Section 8 of Senate Bill 2021 appropriated $200,000 to the Office of Management and Budget for us to contract with a private consultant to conduct an IT relocation and consolidation study of IT equipment operated by the Attorney General's Office, Public Service Commission, the Water Commission, and the Oil and Gas Division of Mineral Resources. OMB did an RFP and awarded a contract to the UMO Group. OMB is required to report the findings and recommendations to the budget section and this committee by March 31st, so this will fulfill that requirement. And then also any proposed legislation would be submitted to this committee by July 1st. Today, Steve Patterson from the UMO Group will be making a presentation on their report and their findings. Steve.
Thank you, Pam. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you very much. You have a copy of the presentation there. I'm just going to kind of walk through that because it provides kind of an executive level summary of our findings.
Did you state your name for the...
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Steve Patterson. I'm representing UMO Group International. I'm going to kind of start on page 3, talking a little bit about the study. And what we highlight here are some of the specific areas that were identified within the RFP that the state of North Dakota asked us to take a look at. Those issues are cost, security, both physical and cyber security positions, redundancy and staffing, impact on service to stakeholders, and potential contract implications of any kind of a relocation or consolidation effort. The first one, the cost figure, was certainly a large topic of discussion during the course of this project with the agencies. And in fact, UMO Group found no opportunity really to reduce costs through an initiative of relocating the existing equipment from their current locations within the agencies to the central IT facility, nor any cost savings in a consolidation effort, which would entail replacing those devices that are at the agencies today with equipment that's already installed or would need to be installed within the central IT. We'll talk a little bit more about costs a little bit later, and certainly you may have some questions about that. I would point you to, in the report that you have, pages 2 through 5 are the where we're talking about the findings. Page 22 of the report, there is a table where we've kind of summarized the cost positioning for this study. The next area of study was the security position. First, the physical security in the agencies that were studied, which included the Attorney General's Office, the Public Services Commission, the State Water Commission, and the Oil and Gas Division of Mineral Resources. With the exception of the Attorney General's Office, each of the agencies had provisioned a office with a locked door to be their computer room where they located the equipment that that are used to support their IT efforts. In the three smaller agencies, we found no evidence of any fire suppression capability. In the Attorney General's office, the data center that they have developed is supplemented by integrated power management, uninterruptible power supplies, and they had fire extinguishers in place to be used. The central IT's facility, on the other hand, is a very state-of-the-art environment. They are staffed 24/5.5. The only times that they do not have staff on site is Saturday afternoons and Sundays, whereas the agencies only had staff on site for the most part the 8-to-5 business week. Additionally, the central IT has a very comprehensive disaster recovery and business continuity facility that supplements the services that they provide. Cybersecurity, I've sat here and listened to your discussion earlier about an event that occurred with higher ed. Our position on cybersecurity is that currently the agency's systems are as well protected from hacking activities as other facilities on the state's network. The state's network is fully managed by the central IT with their firewalls, their detection facilities, and things of that nature. We would acknowledge, however, that a locating the equipment that is installed at the agencies in the central IT facility would provide opportunity to improve the monitoring that they are able to do with the facilities that they have in the event that something were able to get past the firewalls and you're looking for unusual activity on the servers. The agencies are utilizing virus protection systems, but the central IT organization has an automated process for updating their virus protection position and for updating what we call patch management, keeping the operating systems at the most current level, which the manufacturers put out patches to respond to the threats that are out there in the marketplace. Redundancy. The agencies have a relatively small complement of IT staff, and we estimate that there's anywhere up to 15% of the time that these IT staff function is in a similar capacity that the IT folks in the central organization would be doing, and that includes installing equipment, installing software, just the basic care and feeding of the systems that they have. The IT staffing at the agencies, these folks are very capable and talented folks, and they have a lot of understanding of the agency challenges. And they've been able to get a lot of work accomplished with their limited budgets. Impact to stakeholders. with the recommendations that we're going to be making to you here, we do not believe that there would be any impact to the stakeholders. In fact, the crux of the recommendations that we're making actually, we believe, improves the position and the protection of the data that are the real resources that are being provided to the constituents of the agencies. Another concern that was identified in the RFP was contractual relationships. There are a couple of situations where software are being used by the agencies that is really software that's being provided by the federal government. However, there is a gamut of the way that organizations are set up across the country, and although there would be some communications and coordination with the affected federal agencies, we do not believe that there are going to be any issues in having the systems in a consolidated fashion. And now on the recommendations page, where you'll see that we actually are not recommending a relocation. We don't really see much value. ITD operates a hosted center where they can relocate equipment on behalf of the agencies. However, they don't provide direct services to that equipment, and so it's up to the agencies or the agency's contractors to be able to come in and manage that equipment. So simply relocating from the agency locations to that facility would require the agencies to travel from their locations, their offices, in to do whatever work they need to do on those systems. So our recommendation really is focused on a consolidation position for those agencies. The Attorney General's office, we're not recommending that they be consolidated. All of the states that I am aware of do not have their highest law enforcement entity with their CJIS networks and systems consolidated in with a central IT facility. The CJIS network is a very complex environment connecting all of the other states, access to all of the other states and to the federal government. CJIS data is highly confidential data and requires, there's a tremendous burden that would be placed on ITD to be able to accommodate CJIS policies and regulations in the way that those systems that are managed and accesses are managed. The other three agencies, however, we do recommend a consolidation be considered. These agencies, for the most part, have a relatively small footprint for the amount of equipment that they have in place, and PSC and oil and gas would fit very easily into the current enterprise architecture that is managed by Central IT. State Water Commission has some additional challenges in that they are utilizing Apple equipment primarily, and that one is something that I think they still would be in a better position, but it does certainly present some challenges in the consolidation initiative for that agency. Hmm. From the benefits of the consolidation, kind of talked a little bit about the cybersecurity already, the improved opportunity for monitoring activity of any kind of an intrusion action that would occur, the virus and malware protection, and the ability to manage that and keep those at the highest levels. The central IT facility has, as I said, they have a very state-of-the-art data center with very comprehensive environmental controls for the equipment. Power backup scenarios that have improved over the last couple of years, and they have an off-site facility that is used for disaster recovery, backup, and recovery, and they are positioned to provide levels of business continuity for the agencies that use their services. With each of the agencies that we talked to, it really became quite apparent that their primary concerns were really in their IT staffs, that they felt confident in their IT staff. As I mentioned earlier, their IT staffs are very competent people. They have a great understanding of the challenges and the needs of the agencies that they work for. And, of course, the agencies have the ability to control the activities that they work on, and they can quickly respond to the demands that the constituents of the agencies place on them. With the opportunity for removing the redundancy and turning over the basic hardware management, care and feeding of the hardware, the security management positioning to ITD, the time that we estimate could be as high as 15% for those agencies can be redirected then into the application development area, identifying new software systems and then getting those implemented and providing end-user support directly within their agencies. Obviously, any kind of a consolidation effort like this, it has its risks. Certainly, we didn't find any issues, technical issues, that couldn't be overcome in this kind of a consolidation issue. To kind of speak a little bit again about cost is going to be higher for the agencies in a consolidated fashion, represented in higher fees that get charged by ITD back to the agency. But I think we believe that you have to look at this from the perspective of it being an investment in the protection of the data that they manage at the agencies. This data is not particularly confidential data, but each of the agency expressed to us, you know, the value that that information provides to the constituents that they work with. There are some organizational and personnel challenges that are going to have to be overcome in this kind of a situation. There is a distrust factor in the agencies, between the agencies and the ITD, that is going to have to be overcome. Additionally, each of the agencies has relatively few IT folks. They have a lot of knowledge invested in those IT folks. If the challenges in working together cooperatively cannot be overcome, and one of those folks would leave, many of them actually are of retirement age today, which is not an unusual position in the public sector, you'd have an awful lot of knowledge that would walk out the door or could walk out the door. Additional learning curve for both ITD and for the agencies and the recommendations that we're making is a risk factor that needs to be looked into. ITD is going to have to look at expanding a base technology that they already have in place that provides virtual server platforms that we're recommending for the agency's use, but expanding upon just basic virtualization strategies into essentially building a private cloud environment that gives the agencies a high level of flexibility in utilizing and obtaining IT resources very comparable to what they would get if they were to go out into the marketplace to a Rackspace or many other agencies that are out there that provide cloud computing services for their use. We are recommending, I should mention that the RFP was really focused on looking at the hardware and software relocation or consolidation. I was not looking at personnel, but we'd like to reiterate that we are recommending that the current agency IT staff stay associated with the agencies that they are currently assigned. They're providing a great service to those agencies today. Talked a little bit about the virtual server environment that needs to be enhanced within ITD to provide the flexibility and the levels of access and capabilities that the agency IT staff will need that are not provided today. We also have taken and we've talked with ITD and taken a look at the policies and procedures that they have in the way that they interact with agencies, and we believe that there needs to be some re-examining those procedures and opening up the doors a little bit into what the agency IT staffs would be capable of doing while still keeping the level of integrity and protection that a central ITD is in place to do for the state. In pages 6 to 8 of the report, we talk a little bit about some critical success factors, and it really involves everybody getting on board with a sense of mission, having a common view, building trust levels and levels of cooperation. One of the items we have on here is marketing. IT organizations are notorious for not really marketing themselves very well. They are motivation levels for IT folks is the accomplishment of getting something put in place, not going out and trying to toot their horn about what they're capable of and what new technologies that they're looking at. We would suggest that that is something that needs to be expanded upon and improved upon. The communication efforts between the IT organization, between ITD and the agencies, is one that we see there are opportunities for enhancing as a part of that marketing strategy that they would need to put in place. And then again, a focus on serving the ultimate customer, which are the citizens of the state of North Dakota, and in providing well-protected and comprehensive capabilities for managing the information resources that the agencies have. That's the end of the presentation. I would be more than happy to respond to any questions you might have at this point.
Thank you. Any questions by the committee? I'm surprised, but you have a pretty in-depth report here as I look through it, but I guess if there's no further questions.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
That's awesome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not a question. We did have a presentation also in budget section yesterday, and I did ask several questions at that point. I have requested legislative management get some additional information on the FBI CGIS and the consolidation in those areas, maybe what other states or municipalities are doing, and they'll present that there, and I would hope to have it in front of this committee also.
Good. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Thorson, one thing did come to my mind after we discussed that yesterday is that when you're looking at the municipal level where you do find that consolidated environment an awful lot, cities are not operating as a CSA. The state levels, they don't have to worry about interconnections between multiple agencies and connections to other states and things of that nature, where the state operations, CGIS operations, do have to be concerned with that activity. So it makes it a much more complex scenario at the state level.
Okay, if there's no further questions, thank you. Appreciate your report. Is there any Anyone in the audience that would like to comment on the report at this time? Okay, seeing none. Okay, committee. One of the things I guess we'll look at is our meeting. Probably look at somewhere around the middle of June. Adam will send an email out with some proposed dates to see if it works for the majority. And I know we've talked about this in the last couple meetings, but I assume everybody's okay that we will look at going to Grand Forks and touring the new IT center at the next meeting. I think that'll be an interesting for this committee to do. So unless there's some objections of that, I think we'll look at doing that for the June meeting. Put that on the agenda for the afternoon. Also, Senator Robbins, your suggestion, I think we'll make sure that's on the agenda for that next meeting. That's a good idea. Anything else that the committee would like to see?
Mr. Chairman, and maybe for Adam's benefit, you know, if there's some dates that we can't make work, maybe we should let Adam know now. I know for my calendar, the 16th of June is the 9th and the 16th are yeah, really tough, as is the 13th and 20th.
Yeah, it wouldn't hurt if you have some specific dates you already know you're not available. If you want to email them to Adam, that'll help as we try to pick a date. So hopefully almost everyone can show up. Representative Mott?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one thing I'd request that be included on the agenda is another update regarding the data breach from the university system. I'd like to get more information.
Yeah, we will have that for sure.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Anything else that anyone wants? And again, you can email Adam anytime if you got something, and you know, we'll see about putting it on the agenda.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
You know, I don't know where we're at as a committee, but maybe just for ITD and higher ed, if there's any need for bill drafts or what have you, I don't know how many more times we're going to meet, but it might be worth at least advising the committee that something might be forthcoming at our June meeting, because we might only meet a couple times after that.
And we'll probably
just
meet only twice after that.
Right.
Yeah, it's the other thing, committee. If you're looking at a bill draft, or if anybody else is, you know, we do need to. Session will be here before we know it, good or for bad. But anything else for the good of the order this morning? We're still going to get down early. If not, we're adjourned.